Today's Teisho is case 52 in the Heikagon Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 52 is entitled Joshu's Stone Bridge. Main subject, a monk said to Joshu, "The stone bridge of Joshu is widely renowned, but coming here I see only a set of stepping stones." Joshu said, "You see only the stepping stones and do not see the bridge." The monk said, "What is the stone bridge?" Joshu said, "It lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over." Sutcho's verse, "No show of transcendence, but his path was high. If you've entered the great sea of Zen, you should catch a giant turtle. I can't help laughing at old Kankei, his contemporary, who said, it is quick as an arrow, a mere waste of labor." So, I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning. Everybody's been really working hard on the cushion. Thank you so much for making that effort. So it's a beautiful day. Summer is here. Flowers are blooming. Beautiful. What a wonderful paradise, really, to be able to practice under these conditions. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. It's really wonderful. So today's Teisho is basically a stone bridge of Joshu. And I've talked about Joshu quite a bit, but he certainly was probably you could argue he was the greatest Zen master of the Tang Dynasty. He was a very young man in his late teens when he went to a sesshin. And he had a Daikensho, great awakening experience. And, you will meet people who have had such experiences, and that can be an occasion for a lot of pride and self-satisfaction. Many, many years ago, there was a guy who would come to our sesshins just on the weekend. And he let me know that he had gone to study with another teacher. And he said, "I studied with so-and-so and I had Kensho." And he said it very self-importantly. And I said, "Just one?" And he looked at his face and very... he had a big frown on his face. And every time he'd mention it, I'd say, "Oh, just one?" Joshu had more than just one. When he was this teenager, he went to sesshin. He was already a young monk and had Daikensho. And instead of saying, going around telling people, "I've had Kensho," he said, "How can I deepen this experience? How can I deepen this experience?" So he went looking for his teacher, looking for another teacher, and basically found a master, Nansen, Nanchuan. And Joshu studied with Nanchuan for many, many years, like 40 years, until Nansen died. And everybody expected Zhao Zhou, to take over Nansen's temple, but instead of doing that, Joshu set out on the road in China and went all over China meeting deeply enlightened teachers, having encounters with deeply enlightened teachers. Now, this takes a lot of chutzpah. because, you know, he was a best student of Nanzen. But it's one thing to study with your teacher for 40 years. It's another thing to go and visit other teachers. And you go and sit with somebody else, and I'm sure even the great Jiaozhou, even Joshu, must have had some trepidation at some point. You know, like going to sit with a strange teacher, what will be the reaction of the teacher? When the teacher challenges Joshu, will Joshu be able to respond in a way that accords with his reputation as a great practitioner of Zen? And, you know, I don't imagine that when Joshu went, he made a big fuss about arriving. I imagine that when he went, he just came in and sat down on the cushion and went to Dokusan in the evening and saw the teacher at the temple where he was sitting. And he allowed himself to be challenged. And that takes a lot of nerve, right? A lot of chutzpah. He had to really be willing to put himself out there. I myself had that experience. You know, when I finished training with Webb Roshi, I came out here because I found a job at Rutgers. And there was really nowhere for me to, you know, in Seattle, I could have driven a cab, which is a perfectly good way to make a living, or a bus. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something else with my life. And one of my friends in the PhD program, actually, Brad was his name, drove a bus. And actually, he's a poet. And if you've seen the movie Patterson, if you haven't seen the movie Patterson, I highly urge you to see Patterson. It's a wonderful movie about a bus driver who's a poet, right? It's a great movie. My friend Brad got his PhD, and the job market was so terrible that he rode a bus, and he's published books of poetry, and he has an excellent healthcare plan, and a good retirement as a Washington State civil servant. So, you know, it's worked out for him, but I just didn't want to do that, even though it was very difficult for me to pull up roots, because I had made so many friends in Seattle and come out here. And when I came out here to Rutgers, there was really little Dharma action on the ground, you know. So I knew there was a teacher in the Catskills and in the city. And I went up and studied with him, a man named Edo Roshi. And, Edo Roshi, his style was very pugnacious, right? So, you know, the first time we did Dokusan, he really challenged me. He really, challenged me. He sort of slightly insulted me, like, basically, you say you're finished your training, but all I see are these stepping stones. I don't see any stone bridge. And that was his style. You know, different teachers have different styles. His style was very aggressive and combative sometimes. And I think what he was trying to do is to see if I responded with like pride or something. If I said, "Well, I am the student of, you know, Kangan Glenn Webb, you know, who's the student of so and so," and I didn't do that. I went back to my cushion and I tried to respond next time to the koan he had given me. But his style was definitely intimidating, and I really didn't like it. I studied with him for 6 years on and off, but I didn't appreciate being insulted like that. I guess he was trying to find out who I was, you know. And so Joshu did the same thing. You know, he went out on the road and he would present himself at a temple. And until the Cultural Revolution in China, it was possible for any registered monk or nun to go to any public temple in China and present your you basically had like an ID card. You had some papers. And you presented your papers, and if you were a monk or a nun in good standing, you were admitted to the institution. You were assigned a room, and you were given your duties, and you were told, you know, be there at, you know, 4:30 in the morning for chanting, right? And that was how it worked. So you know, Joshu went all over China, and people would definitely treat him with great respect because he had a reputation. You know, even in his own lifetime, Nansen and Joshu were legendary practitioners of Zen. So, you know, all over China, people had heard of these two people, these two student and teacher, who had deeply awakened, and of course, their stories were legendary. The story of Nansen kills a cat and Joshu puts the shoes on his head. So Joshu would go to these temples and he would present himself, and then the master would challenge him, and sometimes a student would challenge him. So basically, sometimes students would think, well, you know, you're the great master Joshu. Let's see what would you say about this, you know, and this I think was really good for everybody who challenged Joshu, to meet somebody who was so deeply awake. But it was also very good for Joshu. You know, we can't really grow and develop if we aren't challenged by our circumstances. And yet, you know, the truth is, we all work fairly hard to eliminate all challenges to our circumstances, right? I mean, it's human nature to do this. So you know, we all try. I mean, look, nobody wants to get up in the morning and not know how to get to work, right? I mean, if my car doesn't start regularly, I take it to the car repair place. I definitely don't want a lottery situation, you know. It might start and it might not, you know. People are counting on me to show up. It can't be too much of an adventure to drive my car, right? And I have to, I just got a new computer because my computer was turning into too much of an adventure. You know, things were not working properly, and someday it was very slow, and some days there were other problems. And I want something that I can dependably turn on and do this, this, and this, and so on. So you know, we all do this. You know. When I go home at night, I'm not in any doubt about where I'm going to sleep. You know, I know my bed is waiting for me, my house is waiting for me, you know. And so we all do this. But the price we pay for this is that we don't get to know ourselves very well, and we don't expand our understanding of not just ourselves, but of the mind, of Buddha nature. It's definitely the case that we all need, we're required to, and we have to, live a very highly regimented life. And somebody like Joshu was willing to sort of put that at risk, right? I mean, he's definitely like one of these people who, when I was quite young, when I had just finished college, maybe that's not so young to some people, I wanted to have an adventure, so I hitchhiked across the United States with my friend Larry Sullivan. And that was an adventure, right? You know, I never knew where I was going to sleep. I never knew if I was going to get a ride the next day. I never knew what I was going to eat. And it actually taught me a lot about myself that I didn't know, you know. I realized, that I wasn't very good at handling uncertainty. So, you know, it really bothered me not to be able to control my transportation. You know, if you hitchhike, it's an interesting relationship to the world because, You know, when you get in your car, you start the car and you drive from point A to point B. But when you hitchhike, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to go from point A to point B. You roughly are going from Seattle to Albuquerque, right? How you get there is really depending on what rides you catch. You know, so if somebody's going through California, you can go down through California and across through Arizona into Albuquerque. Or you can go through Idaho and Montana and down through Denver. See, and so, you know, hitchhiking is like that. Also, you know, you can wash your face, you can comb your hair, you can stand out by the side of the road with a smile on your face, but you still might not get a ride for hours and hours, you know. And I tried to be very presentable and neat. This was a different America, by the way. You can't really do this anymore, but lots of people hitchhiked, and I worked very hard at being a charming hitchhiker. I had sort of like a golf hat that I wore, sort of like a funny hat. It wasn't goofy, but it was just sort of disarming, you know. And I had my backpack. Everything was very neat and clean, and I looked non-threatening as I could. And, you know, I would get rides, but, you know, you might spend the whole morning just sitting there watching a scrub jay pecking at the dirt, right? And for me, this caused me a lot of really emotional turmoil, you know, a lot of emotion, but I really did change. Hitchhiking really changed me in a way. It's like, look, I'm going to Albuquerque from Seattle. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I'm going to get there. And, you know, I don't know when I'm going to get there, but roughly next week, right? And you know, people would pick me up, and they were charming people. They, you know, one guy was in a film industry in Hollywood. You know, one guy had a big farm in Eastern Oregon. People would, you know, again, this was a different time, but, you know, a lot of people smoked recreational marijuana. They'd offer me a joint. They'd take me home to their home for dinner, you know. So, you know, it was the world I never got growing up in a very conventional way. You know, I met some people who were pretty interesting people, you know, people in the music industry. I met a person in Utah who made some of the most beautiful musical instruments in the world, and he said he had like 6 years of back orders, right? So he was such a, he made guitars and other stringed instruments, and he also made like clavichords and things like that, and he had this beautiful house out in the woods, basically in Utah, and he, you know, he was so good that he had a job for the foreseeable future, basically. And he was so nice to me, and he gave me a meal, and we chatted, and, you know, so it was a real eye-opening experience. You know, I lived in a very regimented way, and I'm so happy I had this experience, because I didn't really understand the world very well going from point A to point B. You know, but when I began to wander aimlessly, yeah, really, somewhat aimlessly, I mean, I did want to go to Albuquerque. When I began to wander, I began to learn things I did not expect to learn. And this was an incredible life lesson for me. I'm so glad I had that experience, because it really opened me up. It made me more flexible. I mean, I work with people who are very high-powered English-type professors. And a lot of these people have gone to, like, Ivy League schools, which I didn't go to. And they've gone from, like, private school to Yale to Harvard to Rutgers. And I have to say, I think their lives have been very narrow. You know, I really enjoyed the school of the road. You know, it was a marvelous, magical experience. And I think it prepared me for Zen training. It really prepared me for Zen training, because Zen is a lot like hitchhiking. You know, you go out, you get up in the morning, you comb your hair, you make sure you look presentable. You get out, if you don't, you know, a ride could come at any time. So if you're a hitchhiker, you don't want to spend too long at the 7-Eleven getting a burrito, right? You want to get it, eat it, and get back on the road, because while you're eating your burrito, the ride that goes to California could be passing, right? So you go to the bathroom, you splash some water on your face, you stop at the 7-Eleven, you get a burrito, and then you're out there on the road, and then who knows what's going to happen. And Zen is like that. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you're waiting for the ride, right? You're waiting to be picked up and taken somewhere by your koan. And you don't know where it's going to go. And you don't know when you're going to get picked up. And I definitely had days hitchhiking when I was on the edge of thinking, okay, I'm going to catch a bus, you know, and stop doing this. But the bus would have been such a loss, right? Because I wouldn't have met all these interesting people. In those days, for $99, you could get an Ameripass bus pass. And you could, for $99, you could go anywhere in the United States for 6 months on the bus. It was a great deal, but I absolutely didn't want to do that. Because, you know, you're just going from one destination to another. This was a totally open-ended experience. Well, Zen is like that too. When you sit down on the cushion, you're waiting for your ride, and you don't know when it's going to come, and you don't know where it's going to take you. So you develop patience, right? And you develop receptivity, and you develop flexibility, right? All of these things are incredibly valuable qualities. And generally speaking, people who do Zen develop a great openness to the world, right? You know, I can't control anything, even though I can control my car and I can control, you know, my heating bill by setting my thermostat down in the winter, I really can't control anything. You know, life is really, in some ways, completely out of our control. And we create an illusion of control, or sort of a bubble of control. And in some ways that closes us off from everything that we really crave, you know. It's almost like, you know, people get to a place where they're safe, and then life becomes less revealing, less interesting. Now, you know, if you're in an unstable situation, you probably crave stability, and that's totally understandable. I mean, I get a check every 2 weeks. You know, when I was in college, I used to make fun of I used to tell my friends, I don't want to have a 9-to-5 job. I'd say, yeah, the 9-to-5 job isn't for me. So one of my first jobs when I got out of college was running a restaurant, and that's a 7 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night job. And I wished to God I had a 9-to-5. It's like, what was wrong? Why? I didn't understand, you know. Restaurant work is so, it's just crushing, right? It's like 6 days a week from the time you get up until the time you go to bed. So we learn things. We can't learn much from what we want to have happen. We can only learn from the things we don't want to have happen or don't know about. And so, you know, one way to understand Zen is that it's doing exactly this. It's making yourself open to life in a radical way. We learn how to be open and trust life in the process of waiting on the corner for a ride. It's so much like hitchhiking, you know. And Joshi was a hitchhiker, basically. Joshi went all over China encountering teachers. And it must have been a little scary to meet his, contemporaries of his teacher or his own contemporaries who were formidable practitioners of the Dharma. And his ego was on the line, right? You're the great Joshu. But what a wonderful person he was to have done that, right? What an amazing person to have been willing to come off his high horse and be... And you know, Joshu doesn't, in some of these encounters, Joshu doesn't always get the last word, you know? So it's not like he always knew the answer. You know, there must have been times where he was left scratching his head. But I'm sure whoever he met, if that person was worth his own, had been practicing for a long time, I'm sure whoever he encountered would have been in admiration of Joshu's openness, right? Openness to possibility. You know, and it's actually very hard to be open in that way, even if you want to be open. You know, people go on vacations, but vacations are actually not particularly... I'm not criticizing vacations, understand, please. I like to take a vacation too. But so often, vacations are not really... they're not really opening up experiences. Sometimes they can be, you know, but often they're highly controlled encounters with uncertainty, right? So you go to a new place, but you're, you know, if you're like me, who makes sure you have some hotels lined up or some places to sleep lined up in advance, and maybe you have a tour you're going with, it's a little more difficult to hitchhike into a town and not know where you're going to sleep. And maybe sleep under a bridge on the interstate, which I have done, and I don't recommend, but it's not bad, actually. So you know, Zen is a way of really opening up to the unforeseen possibilities in ourselves and also in the world. And you know, we tend to think only of the self as, well, we all have a concept of the unconscious. You know, most people have a concept of the unconscious. And they think of the unconscious as their personal unconscious. And this is definitely something that exists. So, you know, when you are on the cushion, sometimes things come up that you'd completely forgotten about. You know, you have closed off maybe something in your life. And then, you know, on day two or day three of Sesshin, this starts coming back into your awareness. You remember something. I remember yesterday I was sitting towards the end of the evening. I remembered getting in a fight on the playground with a kid named Billy when I was like in the sixth grade. And I remember how terrified I was when they took us to the principal's office. I'm sure I haven't remembered this in 50 years. But I also remember, I remembered with shame, you know, that I was, you know, very aggressive in that response. Maybe I didn't have to respond so aggressively. You know, I socked him. And I thought, did I really do that? You know, I can't believe I did that. But I did. I socked him and then I lied about it, you know. That was a shocker for me. I've closed that off. And it's not part of my self-image, you know. Why did I do that? You know, I was sitting with that for a while. What was it? Why did I do that? So, you know, that's the personal unconscious. We close off things in ourselves, but also, you know, the whole world in a certain way is our unconscious. If you don't really believe that the self is entirely real, you know, we're all part of this big network. You know, we're all like little nodes in a net. And so, you know, everything you discover is really self-discovery in a certain sense. You know, everything is myself in a certain way. And when you're on the cushion, you know, you have those experiences where you suddenly hear the bird and you feel you are the bird, or you hear the rain and you realize you are the rain. And, you know, so there's a kind of unconscious revelation that happens on the cushion when you recall something in your life. But the whole world is, in a way, our unconscious mind. And so, you know, as we are opening up to things, we're encountering parts of ourselves we didn't fully understand or even weren't even aware of. So this practice of Zen is really about, it's like, this, you know, there's a Zen of motorcycle maintenance, there should be a Zen of hitchhiking. Because, you know, we're really about opening up to whatever comes and trusting in the process. And when something is happening that we don't like, we naturally recoil. We naturally close it down. You know, but when we do that, you know, it's like a showing a lack of trust. And when we do that, it locks us in again, right? You know, so you know, when I did recall hitting that kid on the playground, it wasn't a totally unprovoked attack. I didn't walk up and, but we were having an argument about a basketball, and I did, you know, he pushed me and I socked him. And then we went to the principal's office, and he was sobbing. And I said, I didn't mean to hit him. And he said, oh, you did. You meant to hit me. And I looked at the teacher like, no, I didn't. And I got away with it. You know, amazing, right? No, I was sitting there thinking, why did I do that to that kid? You know, he really didn't deserve to be socked. He was, you know, why did I do that? I had some new insight into some elements of my life. I never would have had that if I hadn't been hitchhiking on the cushion last night, you know, waiting for something to turn up. Whatever turns up that we expect can't teach us anything. Only what we don't expect or desire can teach us something. And when we encounter something we don't want to know, it's like looking across a chasm, right? But, you know, the practice of Zazen is realizing that that chasm isn't really there. If you don't, you create the chasm. You create the separation. So there's no stone bridge if your habit is not to take a risk. There's just stepping stones. But if you're willing to sit in deep mushin and, you know, you have your thumb out on the road for whatever comes and you're struggling to welcome whatever comes, you know, lo and behold, you have firm footing as you walk. You know, so we create the separations. They lock us in, and they do it so well that we need like a randomizer. You know, you could think of Zazen as a kind of like randomizing device. It's opening us up to what we don't want to confront or don't know about. This is what I think makes Zen so amazingly wonderful. You know, I've been doing this for 40 years. And again, it was sort of like hitchhiking. You know, I was having some stress in graduate school. And I didn't have money for like psychotherapy or something. There was a psychotherapist at the University of Washington, but I think she had like 400 clients or something. You know, so you got one visit. I was having trouble with stress, and I heard about this Tibetan center on 45th. And I went to it, and nobody was there. There was no teacher. They had a beautiful Tibetan altar and these cushions to sit on, just like our cushions. And I would go there. I had read some books on Buddhism and meditation. I would go there and meditate. And then one day, there was a guy there at the same time as I was there meditating. He said, you know, a Zen master has just come to Seattle from Japan, and he's leading sits at the University of Washington on Wednesday nights. So I went over there and just stuck my hand out, and I went over there, and you know, I met this person who has been so important for my life, Genki Roshi, my first teacher. And the first time I did zazen, I was covered with sweat. You know, I was just like, I couldn't, you know, it was so hard sitting this way. And about 2 months later, I went to sesshin, you know, my first sesshin. It was really an astonishing experience. I could barely walk after about 2 days. And it was just like I was crawling. It was an amazing, I'm so glad I was open to that experience. It opened a whole different world up to me. So, you know, it's generally the case that our chasms, our barriers, our sense of groundlessness in life is caused by ourselves. I mean, I realize, you know, I've been without a job. There have been times in my life when I've had, you know, like $14 in my pocket. I didn't cause that, for sure. But nevertheless, one way to look at life is as a frightening series of challenges. And another way of looking at life is like, what could be coming that can allow me to be more fully present with the world? Something's happening now that could allow me to be more fully present with the world. And that's a way of responding to external circumstances. But it's also a way of responding to internal challenges, right? You know, the beauty of koans is that people don't know what the hell to do, right? If you knew, it would be useless. You know, when I do give people koans and they can solve them quickly, that's a big problem. You know, I have to sort of scratch my head and think, no, okay, well, let me... Last night somebody came in and said, this koan is really kicking my ass, you know? And I felt so good. It's like, oh, I'm doing a good job today. Because, you know, if the koan is not really kicking your ass, so to speak. I don't mean it's causing you pain, but I mean it's you don't know what to do. There's not much chance for opening up and encountering something more deeply. Being lost, being helpless, being at the mercy of the universe is the only way people can really develop enlightened mind. So you know, control Zen is not about control. Zen is not about control. Control is highly overrated. You know, because control means, you know, I am going to get the effect that I want. Whereas Zen is about I am going to make myself an instrument of this beautiful life energy that we call Buddha nature. And you can't make yourself an instrument by sitting down on the cushion and saying, okay, now I'm an instrument of Buddha nature. You're not an instrument of Buddha nature. That's not so. How do you make yourself an instrument of Buddha nature? Not knowing. Being confused, being uncertain, sometimes being bored, sometimes being afraid. But in all of those ways, you're making yourself available to your own awakening, your own Buddha nature. So Joshu knew all of this. He knew that he can't control anything. He knew that the only way to live in a bigger world is to be uncertain, is not to know. And mu shin. And so there were all obstacles, all chasms became bridges. The bridge, the great stone bridge of Joshu, was created by his openness to being wrong, being confused, being lost. Let's see. A monk said to Joshu, the stone bridge of Joshu. Everybody's talking about you, the great Joshu, and you're teaching of the stone bridge. You always teach about the stone bridge. But I see you, all I see are a bunch of stepping stones. Or maybe he's saying, you have a stone bridge, but when I look at my life, man, it's just a few stepping stones and I'm always about to fall in. And Joshu said, you only see the stepping stones, but you don't realize, you know, the bridge is right there. The monk said, what is the stone bridge? Joshu said, it lets donkeys cross over and it lets horses cross over. See, now, that's not, he's not insulting the monk. He's not saying, you're a donkey, right? He's saying, it doesn't discriminate, right? The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. See, whatever crosses my threshold, I is Buddha. Whatever crosses my threshold is Buddha. So that's how Joshu lived, and that's why his great bridge could let all manner of beings cross over. Setcho's verse, no show of transcendence. See, Joshu's willing to be wrong, confused, lost, even humiliated. His path was high. If you've entered the great sea of Zen, you should catch a giant turtle. I can't help laughing at old Kankei, Joshu's contemporary, who said, it is as quick as an arrow, a mere waste of labor. So I think what he's saying there is that, you know, if you're worried about answering your koan on some kind of a timetable or getting into samadhi very quickly, you know, that's like a circus trick. You know, who cares about that? You know, it's all about being open to the universe, right? Being open-hearted. I am the servant of everything I encounter. I try. I don't always succeed at that, but that's our job. I acknowledge everything that comes across the threshold as Buddha, or I try. That's why I have to do zazen. And that could take a month. It could take 2 minutes. It could take what it takes. It's not about speediness. It's about openness.